Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Corpus Domini, Pope Benedict leads the traditional procession through the streets of Rome, remembering why we celebrate this feast of the body and blood of our Lord through the Eucharist. Weapons of terror. A former UN arms inspector presents the Pope with a new report calling on world governments to get serious about global nuclear disarmament. And up in smoke in Malta, the Jesuit Refugee Service braves arson attacks and threats as they strive to help shipwrecked asylum seekers. But how far does the xenophobia go? Hello and welcome to the program. Those are the top stories on today's edition. I'm Tracy McClure, your host over the next half hour. Thanks for joining me. Thursday marks the Feast of Corpus Domini, or the Body and Blood of the Lord. On this day, the Pope traditionally presides a special evening Mass on the steps of the Basilica of St. John Lateran here in Rome. Then, accompanied by thousands of Romans and pilgrims, the Holy Father leads a procession to the Basilica of St. Mary Major, about a mile away. But what exactly is the Feast of Corpus Domini, and why does the date it is celebrated on change every year? Linda Bordoni gives us a clue.
The Feast of the Body and Blood of Christ, or Corpus Domini, celebrates the doctrine of the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. The solemnity was established by Pope Urban IV in the 13th century, not long after the Fourth Lateran Council reaffirmed this doctrine in the face of much theological debate on the issue. Formerly it was known as Corpus Christi, the Body of Christ, and there was a separate feast celebrating the precious blood. The current church calendar combines the two into a single celebration. In many places of the world, as it is here in Rome, it's still celebrated on its traditional day, the Thursday after Trinity Sunday. That day was chosen by the church to remember Holy Thursday, the day on which the Eucharist was instituted.
The prefect of the Congregation for Divine Worship, Cardinal Francis Arinze, explains the significance of this decision.
The Church, with the coming and going of the centuries, saw the usefulness of choosing another day to put the focus, the emphasis, on adoration of the Holy Eucharist outside Mass. The Holy Eucharist outside Mass is closely related to the celebration of the Eucharistic sacrifice because it is at the end of Mass the hosts not received by the people. The hosts are put in the tabernacle. We come then to adore Christ privately or in groups. But gradually, there developed also the practice of Eucharistic procession. We go together as a community. We adore Christ. We sing hymns in his honor. We show our love for him. We show our faith. Yes, our Catholic faith.
Cardinal Francis Arinze, prefect of the Congregation for Divine Worship.
Oh.
Weapons of Terror, that's the name of a new report prepared by the former chief arms inspector of the UN, Hans Blix, and the Independent Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission. At the close of Wednesday's general audience, attended by thousands here under the Roman sun, Blix spoke privately with Pope Benedict XVI on the steps of St. Peter's Basilica. He gave him a copy of the new dossier. Reporters who witnessed the meeting said Pope Benedict listened carefully to Blix, who also once headed up the International Atomic Energy Agency, the UN's nuclear monitoring agency.
I was very honored and happy to meet the Pope and to present him with a report on weapons of terror, weapons of mass destruction, which an international commission of 14 members, which I have chaired, has finished.
Speaking to Vatican Radio, Hans Blix said the report, presented earlier to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, warns about the pervasive dangers of nuclear weapons.
I told the Pope that we have the same line as he does, that the search for truth is vital in the search for peace. Before the outbreak of the Iraq war, the inspectors which I led from the United Nations in New York, they were professionals, and they sought objectively as you can, to examine whether Iraq had any weapons of mass destruction. We carried out 700 inspections in the short time we were there, 500 different sites, and we reported to the Security Council of the World that we did not find any. We also went to several dozen sites given to us by intelligence services, sites that they suspected, and we told them that in none of these sites did we find any weapons of mass destruction. So here was a search for truth, and our reports were pretty close to that, whereas the National Intelligence Services went totally wrong. So for the future, we need more international verification. We need national intelligence too, and we are not against that, but you need to have both. It is a disaster to have a whole Iraq war based upon erroneous information.
Blix says the experts who drafted the report are urging the international community to rekindle efforts towards global disarmament.
It is a report written by people, experts from all around the world. And this report submits that we must revive disarmament efforts. Disarmament efforts are at the present time at a low ebb. The conference that the world has set up for dealing with disarmament, the CD in Geneva, has not been able to work for 8 years. They have not been able to agree on an agenda. And one reason is that they operate by consensus, by unanimity. So it's enough that any one state says no. And only a few days ago, it was proposed that they should discuss the risk of weaponization of outer space. And the US and the UK were against it, while Germany and a number of other states were in favor of it. So we are at a low ebb, and we don't hope that after the Iraq war, after the war in Iraq, that there would be a reflection in many states that military means have their limitations. That it is true that treaties also have some weaknesses, yes, but military means are shown to have limitations, and that there might be a greater return to the global approach.
Former UN Chief Weapons Inspector Hans Blix speaking there to Vatican Radio following his brief meeting Wednesday with Pope Benedict XVI. On the tiny southern European island of Malta, hostility is growing against illegal migrants who have been landing on the island's shores in unprecedented numbers over the past 3 years. Most land on Malta by mistake while trying to reach Italy from Libya. Only a tiny handful are granted asylum status, and the rest are held under lock and key for up to 18 months in grim detention centers. Susie Hodges picks up the story.
Trapped
trapped in a place where they don't feel welcome. That's the feeling expressed by Ali Garar, a migrant from war-torn Somalia, who was washed ashore in Malta in 2004, whilst on his way to a hoped-for new life in mainland Europe. Ali, who worked as a teacher in his homeland, says the hostility of many Maltese people towards him and the other illegal immigrants from Africa is palpable.
They are trapped here and there is nowhere to go. The problem is that Maltese now, there is a lot of xenophobia which is increasing in the country, and you just feel it inside the bus, wherever you are going, in any office you are going, whoever you are dealing with, you just feel it, the rejection. You just feel that they don't want you here. There were a lot of people who were attacked. That's the problem, and now we are just feeling that we are no more safe. And before, they used to come and chase people with a car, and that's what was happening.
Their predicament causes many of them to sink into a state of despair, as Ali explains.
Everyone is desperate now because you are no more feeling safe and you don't have where to go. That's the reality we are facing now. They are all disappointed. We are just struggling in life and we hope that one day there will be some kind of hope.
But not all the Maltese people are showing a hostile face to the migrants, and many are reaching out to provide a helping hand to the newcomers. The main non-government office that provides assistance to the migrants and helps ease their integration into Maltese society is the Jesuit Refugee Service, whose director is Father Paul Pache. He says although not all the Maltese people harbour xenophobic feelings towards the African migrants, it's easy to get the impression that these people are in the majority.
Obviously, those who are hostile make more noise, so it could be very easily the impression that everybody is against them, but I don't think it is like that. All the noise that is made because we are being invaded, we can't have all these people coming here, we don't want them here. Obviously, this frightens people, but because wherever we have had human contact, people change. There is no hostility, I think, in general, when people work and meet together.
But is it fair to say that, you know, Malta being an island, perhaps its people are rather insular and it's a sort of small, tightly knit community, and there is perhaps this fear of their culture, their language, their religion being swamped somehow by these newcomers?
Yes, I'm sure that fear exists. We have months where we have boats coming in 2 or 3 times a week. They are coming small numbers, 20, 25. But the impression that people get from just looking at television or reading the newspaper is that this is a flow that we can do nothing about, that this will never come to an end, that people are coming all the time and what are we going to do with them, and they will remain here, they will take our jobs. And these messages, unfortunately, are being repeated over and over again.
These hostile messages, says Father Paul, are also reinforced by openly racist graffiti, sometimes painted on walls in Malta, saying things like, "Blacks go home."
One does see graffiti, one does hear these comments. When people get on a bus or meet one another on the street, people are not used. The fact that these people are put into detention for 18 months creates the impression that these are a big threat to us, so we should be afraid of them, we should be very careful. Unfortunately, for example, when they are taken to hospital, they are taken to hospital in handcuffs. So anybody who sees them considers them to be criminals. So when these people leave detention, they find a hostile atmosphere awaiting them, which is very unfair and very unfortunate.
In recent months, this hostile atmosphere against the African migrants in Malta has occasionally boiled over into acts of violence. And for the first time on the island, the Jesuit Refugee Service has found itself on the front line of this backlash, with its staff and property coming under a series of arson attacks, as Father Paul explains.
These were a very, very unfortunate turn of events. Last November, well, one of the Jesuit communities had 2 of its cars burned during the night. And last March, the Jesuit community at our school had all its 7 cars burned down during an arson attack during the night. About a month later, the assistant director of JRS, a lawyer, had her car burned down and her home door burned down as well. And even a couple of journalists who, among many other things, are very clearly in favor of the rights of these people. Yeah, they were the victims of arson attacks. which is something, this type of violence is something which has never been, I don't know, arson has not been widespread at all in Malta. We have never had this type of attacks, and it's very clear that there is a kind of a campaign. People who speak out in favor of migrants, of their rights, of encouraging Maltese to be more welcoming, criticizing racism, these people are being intimidated into silence.
So would you think then that these attacks are somehow being coordinated rather than just random ones by a group of individuals?
It would be very difficult to say, but there have been some very striking coincidences. For example, the three attacks on Jesuit property or on the JRS assistant director took place 1 or 2 days after the Jesuits took a public stand about either migration or racism. So it is very difficult to say that there is no connection at all between the different attacks. Still, nobody has yet been charged with these arson attacks, so it is all conjecture, but I think there is a lot of evidence pointing to something which is organized.
And how would you describe the morale of the people who work for JRS in the wake of these arson attacks? Are staff very fearful for their personal safety?
Obviously, at the beginning, it was a big shock, because to have your house door burned down is something extremely serious and something which had never occurred to us. We had never received any threat. But I think we rallied around and, okay, we are more careful. We are aware that there is this danger. But on the other hand, we have found a lot of support, people who encourage us to go on with our work, people who show their appreciation, they tell us how much they admire us and tell us it's so important to go on defending these people, their dignity, their rights. On the one hand, obviously, it creates some fear, and on the other hand, we found a lot of support which encourages us.
The bitter irony is that the African migrants in Malta virtually never planned or wanted to come to the island in the first place, but simply ended up there by mistake. Father Paul again.
I must say, I have never met one single migrant who said he wanted to come here. But they are on the way to Italy, they are on their way to Europe, and either there is a storm and their boat breaks down, or they ran out of petrol, or they ended up here by mistake. It's good to keep in mind that most of them, the biggest groups come from Sudan, from Somalia, from Ethiopia or Eritrea. So most of these people have never seen the sea in their lives. And they are put in the small boat and told, okay, now you go in that direction. So it's very easy for them to get lost, to run out of fuel, to go around in circles. And when they are picked up by the Maltese armed forces, if they are in distress, they end up here. And as soon as they are here, they come here, they are put into detention.
In one sense, those who actually end up landing on Malta's shores are lucky, because many migrants who travel across the Mediterranean Sea from Africa in often overcrowded and rickety boats, perish en route. Father Paul says this is borne out by the corpses of Africans that sometimes wash up on Malta's beaches.
Bodies are washed up on our shores, but nobody really knows how many started the trip without ever finishing it. Some say the Mediterranean is the biggest mass grave in the world at the moment, because so many people, either because they get lost or because there are storms or because they run out of fuel, that they end up at the bottom of the sea.
Around 1,500 illegal immigrants are currently being held in 8 locked detention centres across Malta that have been likened to prisons. Father Paul says the conditions at these centres are rightly a cause for concern.
That's the most controversial and, we believe, the most unfortunate aspect of our immigration problem, that these people are put in these detention centres, which were not built as detention centres. Some of them are army barracks, others are warehouses, which have been transformed into detention centres. The conditions have been criticised by many international organisations, by the Council of Europe, Commissioner for Human Rights, Committee for the Prevention of Torture, by Amnesty, by the European Parliamentary Delegation a few months ago. Basically, they are overcrowded. Sanitary facilities are not adequate. They have practically nothing to do. There is no activity which is organized. And they are deprived of their freedom. Sometimes they have to wait many months before they are even interviewed. So this uncertainty, this lack of information about the procedure that follows, about the situation of their application, this having absolutely nothing to do day in, day out for 18 whole months, and being considered as a threat, as a criminal in a way, it makes life extremely difficult. And we believe that Malta can do much better. First of all, we believe that the detention period will be drastically reduced, that there are viable alternatives to detention, and that even the conditions, with a very little effort, not a huge expense, can be improved in a very significant way.
And when they are eventually released, what happens to them? Are they ever deported back to their home countries?
When they arrive, they apply for asylum, for protection. Once their application is reviewed, once they are interviewed, a decision is reached. If their application is accepted, they are given either refugee status, which is given to a very, very small number. Last year it was less than 10. But then a much bigger number are given what is called humanitarian protection, which is a kind of a temporary refugee status, which has to be renewed every year. Now, those people who are given protection, either refugee status or humanitarian protection, are released immediately. As soon as a decision is taken, they are released from detention. Those who are rejected can appeal. If their appeal is rejected, they have to remain in detention for 18 months. When the 18 months are over, they are freed. In theory, they are waiting for repatriation, but repatriation is proving to be extremely difficult. Very few people are being, in fact, repatriated because of so many bureaucratic problems, especially the difficulty of obtaining a valid travel document for them to be sent back home. So people with status, that is with refugee or humanitarian protection, they have access to the labor market. People who are rejected twice, unfortunately, have no legalized access to the labor market, so most of them have to work illegally.
And how easy is it for them to find jobs, whether legally or illegally?
It depends on many factors, whether, for example, they speak English or not, what skills they have. But most of those who find work in these low-paid jobs, catering industry or construction industry mostly, doing all kinds of odd jobs. Many of them work at a level which is much below their real capabilities, their training, their profession sometimes. Usually they end up doing these manual low-paid jobs, unskilled jobs, which sometimes are refused by Maltese, that Maltese do not want to do this kind of job, so they end up being done by these migrants who are paid even less.
Instead of their dream of embarking on a new life in mainland Europe, the migrants find themselves stuck in a dead-end situation on an island where their presence is often seen as a threat. Not surprisingly, says Father Paul, the immigrants are bitterly disappointed at how things have turned out for them.
Yes, I think it's a sense of deep shock and of deep disappointment. All the effort, most of them have crossed the Sahara Desert at great peril to their lives. They have left everything, their home, their family, their qualifications, their history, with the dream of arriving at a better future, at a better situation in Europe, and they end up in this island where they seem to be stuck. They will not be repatriated because that is very difficult, and they cannot go into Europe because that is impossible because of the European Union rules. So they feel that they are stuck here, they don't want to be here, and it's very tough. But somehow they are mostly, I think, a very resilient group. I always say that if these people have managed to cross the Sahara Desert, to cross the Mediterranean in a tiny boat, to spend 18 long months in detention, they are very strong characters who could make a big contribution to our culture, to our country. Unfortunately, they are not seen as such, and they are seen more as a threat and as something to be avoided if possible.
That was Father Paul Pache, Director of Jesuit Refugee Services in Malta. And you also heard the voice of a Somalian immigrant, Ali Garar. And I'm Susie Hodges.
It's been used and broken and only comes in blue. It's been down a long road, and it got dirty on the way. If I give it to you, will you make it clean, wash the pain away? You can have my heart if you don't mind broken things. You can have my heart if you don't mind these tears. But I heard that you make all things, so I give these pieces all to you. If you want it, you can have my heart. So beyond repair, nothing I could do. Tried to fix it myself, but it was only worse when I got through. Then you walk right into my darkness, and you speak words so sweet. You hold me like a child till my frozen tears fall at your feet. You can have my heart if you don't mind broken things. You can have my heart if you don't mind these tears. But I heard that you make all things new, so I give these pieces all to you. If you want it, you can have my heart.
And on those sobering but uplifting notes, today's program comes to an end. I'm Tracy McClure, wishing all of you a good day or evening, wherever you may be. And remember, at any time, you can hear this and other programs on our website. That's www.vaticanradio.org. You can also drop us a line with your comments to english@vatiradio.va. We'd love to hear from you. Until then, thanks again for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.